This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, the Prime Minister reveals the head of his department is investigating Bridget McKenzie's handling of the sports grants scheme. Also, lawyers for the Christian Brothers in Perth propose a lower payout for a sexual abuse victim because of his poor upbringing. And one of the massive bushfires in New South Wales is finally brought under control, but it's not over yet.
We've still got a ways to go. We've got to get into the autumn before we can really put our feet up and go, wow, that was a bad fire season.
The Prime Minister has asked the head of his department to look into the revelation today that Federal Minister Bridget McKenzie awarded $36,000 to a shooting club of which she was a member. The question, did she breach ministerial standards? It comes after the government has been forced for a full week to defend Senator McKenzie's allocation of sports grants before the last election, found by the Auditor General to have been biased. Others say there are also concerns about the legality of her processes. Also being admitted by the government only tonight, the Prime Minister referred the broader grant program to his department head last Friday. The Prime Minister has stayed away from the media today, but the Attorney General, Christian Porter, has had his turn at explaining the grants as the opposition calls for Bridget McKenzie's political scalp. Here's political reporter Tom Eagledon.
Government ministers are getting hammered about the sports grants controversy whenever they stick their heads up for an interview. Attorney General Christian Porter is no exception. He sat down with Perth Radio 6PR's Gareth Parker today.
Isn't this exactly the sort of thing that makes the public vomit about the conduct of their politicians?
Well, ministers, it's not unusual for ministers to have final authority on grants.
Adding to the controversy are revelations in Nine newspapers today that the then Sports Minister Bridget McKenzie, who was in charge of the sports grants program, failed to disclose that she's a member of the Wangaratta Clay Target Shooting Club before awarding it $36,000. Labor says it's another Bridget McKenzie misfire. Here's Shadow Attorney General Mark Dreyfus.
Bridget McKenzie has a clear conflict of interest, and for that reason alone should be resigning from her position as a minister.
Though it wouldn't be unusual, would it, for members of parliament to be patrons and members of all sorts of sporting clubs and perhaps not even very active members, as appears to be the case here?
She's a full member of this club, and she didn't disclose that she was a member of this club.
Graham Coyle's a committee member of the Target Club and says the money was used to build new toilets so female members no longer had to duck up to the local pub when nature calls.
These ones that we've got here are absolutely magnificent. They're disabled, wheelchair-able, and they're just a godsend as far as the club's concerned.
Christian Porter says part of the job of every parliamentarian is to get involved in community organisations, just like the Clay Target Club.
Like the list of clubs that I, as a local member, would be a patron of or a member of in my electorate is just enormous. And like we actually have to keep a rolling list of
it. There's
that.
A reason you have to keep list of it, so of that course, these situations don't arise.
Yeah, but the situations are different depending on your level of involvement.
And he's playing down last week's report from the Auditor General, which said Senator McKenzie favoured grants for marginal seats the government hoped to win at last year's election when she overrode a list of more deserving community sports bodies her department provided to her.
An assessment that was put by a ranking of the department, in this case Sports Australia, which is a Commonwealth corporate entity, and the minister had also a ranking, and the two of those were interposed and produced the final result.
But there's doubt about whether the legislation establishing the grant even gives the minister the power to interpose or change Sports Australia's recommendations. And it's the Attorney General who's been asked to look into that question.
It's not an investigation or anything like that. I'm just commissioning advice of Australian government solicitors to try and find an answer to a question that was unanswered by the Auditor General.
But Shadow Attorney General Mark Dreyfus is suspicious about a member of the Cabinet looking into the actions of one of his colleagues.
The fact that he is prepared to already defend her shows that he doesn't understand his role as the first law officer of the Commonwealth.
Do you trust, though, that the advice that he will get from essentially senior bureaucrats, legal bureaucrats, will be fair and honest?
Of course, the Australian government solicitor is very competent lawyers at the AGS, but Mr. Porter, at the moment, might very well keep this secret.
Shadow Attorney General Mark Dreyfus. Tom Iggulden, our reporter there, and a spokesman for Senator McKenzie, says because the Clay Target Club membership was worth less than $300, a declaration to the Senate was unnecessary. Well, a 75-year-old Perth man has become the first child sexual abuse victim to have his day in court since Western Australia removed the time limit on bringing such cases. John Thomas Lawrence was abused by three Christian brothers and a lay teacher at the Clontarf and Castledare orphanages in Perth in the 1950s. The perpetrators are all dead, but on the eve of the trial, the Christian Brothers order admitted the abuse. Eliza Borello has been in court today. Eliza, Mr. Lawrence has been giving his evidence today. He's waited a very long time to do it. What's he had to say?
Well, Linda, it was a bit unusual at the start of proceedings today. Mr. Lawrence requested that his barrister, Tim Hammond, be allowed to remove his black robe and appear just in his suit, saying that the garb reminded him of the robes his main abuser, Brother Lawrence Murphy, wore. That request was denied, and Mr. Lawrence was able to proceed with his evidence. There'd been concerns he would be too distressed to do so today. Under questioning from his lawyers, he went on to describe the life he's lived since arriving in Australia as a child migrant from Birmingham in the United Kingdom, aged 8, on the ship The New Australian. And he described that within 2 or 3 weeks of arriving in Australia and being sent to a boys' home in Perth, he'd been raped by Brother Murphy. As he described the excruciating pain of the attack, a man who described himself as a fellow pupil fled the courtroom visibly distressed. Mr. Lawrence went on to describe how the attack made him feel dirty, as if he was worthless. And described, I guess, what he recalled of the attack, and that was Brother Murphy breathing. He said that he stank.
After such horrific abuse, these recollections for him, how has his life been? He must have suffered terribly for years.
Linda, he has described a life of alcohol dependency, overdoses and suicidal thoughts. He said, I've cried for 40 odd years. He's struggled to hold down a job consistently. He has been married, but described a very dysfunctional, particularly dysfunctional sexual relationship with his wife, who he met at Greylands Hospital, which is a facility for people suffering mental health problems here in Perth.
And what has the Christian Brothers Order said about all of this?
The Christian Brothers lawyer, Bettina Mangan, indicated yesterday that she would be arguing for fewer damages than Mr. Lawrence's counsel are seeking regarding lost wages because of the trauma that he suffered. She outlined yesterday what the judge described as a brutal argument, in that she, or the Christian Brothers, believed that Mr. Lawrence wasn't entitled to as much compensation as was being asked for, because he would have had fewer work prospects and educational prospects anyway, because he was a child migrant, didn't have parents from a well-off or professional background, and had been placed in an orphanage at the age of 8.
Thank you very much, Eliza. Eliza Borello outside the Perth District Court today. You're listening to PM on radio, on the ABC Listen app and via podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. On Twitter, I'm at Linda Mottram. Ahead, letters from her Iranian jail reveal British-Australian academic Kylie Moore Gilbert pleading for better conditions and refusing to be recruited as a spy. But is Australia doing enough to get her home?
There seems to be a tendency to downplay, to keep it out of the news cycle. In fact, I think more publicity, constantly reminding and naming and shaming the Iranian authorities responsible, can play a role in expediting the release.
The divide appears to be growing between the federal government and experts over how to combat climate change and deal with the growing bushfire threat. Scott Morrison says hazard reduction is as important as emissions reduction, and maybe more so, he says, because it has a direct practical impact on public safety. The Prime Minister has suggested a national hazard reduction burn system and the naming and shaming of states that don't comply, but that's now being panned by former fire chiefs and scientists. Gavin Coote reports.
Tom Beer predicted worse bushfire conditions under a changing climate more than 30 years ago. The now retired CSIRO researcher first sounded the warning in a 1987 study.
What is really, really scary is how bad the 2019 fires have been, and yet the predictions we made in 1987 are saying, well, hold on, unless something really changes, it's going to get worse, it's not going to get better.
The federal government is now considering a royal commission as part of its response to the bushfire disaster. But unlike Tom Beer, Prime Minister Scott Morrison isn't so keen to talk further cuts to greenhouse gas emissions. Encouraged by his interviewer Peter Credlin on Sky News, he was wanting to focus elsewhere.
And hazard reduction is as important as emissions reduction, and many would argue, I think, even more so because it has an even more direct practical impact on the safety of a person going into a bushfire season.
The Prime Minister has flagged the idea of introducing a national system to track and monitor hazard reduction burns across states and territories, something New South Wales Deputy Premier John Barilaro has shared enthusiasm for.
We have these arbitrary targets. Who set them up? Probably our own agencies who are actually ideologically opposed to hazard reduction. And therefore, if we have a national approach, standards across every state, takes it out of the hands of individual agencies, let alone states.
But others aren't so supportive of a national hazard reduction system. ACT Chief Minister Andrew Barr thinks the Army could play a role in land clearing and fuel reduction.
This is a problem that every jurisdiction is going to face. Naming and shaming will not be the answer. It will be practical ways to get in and get the work done in a safe way.
But looking for simple ways to tackle a complex problem is something a group of ex-emergency chiefs see as unhelpful. Lee Johnson is a former Queensland Fire and Emergency Commissioner and a member of Emergency Leaders for Climate Action.
Hazard reduction in itself, whilst is a valuable tool, is not the answer. And I'm afraid that to build up people's hopes to think that more hazard reduction burning is going to solve all our problems, it's just not correct.
Another man on the world stage keen to steer the focus away from emissions reduction is Donald Trump. He's in Davos, talking up a pledge for the United States to be part of a trillion tree program.
To embrace the possibilities of tomorrow, we must reject the perennial prophets of doom.
That message was in stark contrast to another big name at the Swiss resort, the young climate activist Greta Thunberg.
Planting trees is good, of course, but it's nowhere near enough of what is needed, and it cannot replace real mitigation.
And retired CSIRO scientist Tom Beer thinks planting more trees is a perfectly acceptable way of cutting greenhouse emissions. But it won't mean all that much under worsening fire conditions.
Now, if that shortening of the interval between major catastrophic fires continues, that means we're likely to be having them every few years, in which case you burn down the trees about as fast as you can plant them.
Retired CSIRO scientist Tom Beer speaking with Gavin Coote. Well, it's a very blustery afternoon, though cool, on Kangaroo Island, where the fires were finally contained yesterday. But many people are still on edge. The winds have brought back memories of the gales that drove the inferno that caused such loss there, with a huge toll on lives, including two deaths, on businesses and on the nature the island is so well known for. Our reporter Rhett Burney arrived on Kangaroo Island a little earlier today. I asked him about the conditions.
Certainly different weather conditions to what the island has been seeing over the last couple of weeks. However, it's really that wind that I think has got people on edge right now.
How on edge are people? I mean, I can hear around you there are people in a store there, I think. Is the place busy or are people apprehensive? What's the feeling like?
It's fair to say that people are apprehensive. I'm at the local Pandana General Store and Post Office. Spoke to a woman who said that every time the wind comes back, it just makes her think, oh gosh, are we going to be evacuated again? She said that, you know, her bags are still packed from the last two evacuations that she's taken part in. And that's simply because even though they're being told that the threat has significantly reduced, people are still on edge, they're still on alert. I spoke with Sandy Davis, who owns the store that I'm at the moment, and here's what she had to say.
Everyone's just in massive recovery mode, trying to get back to some sort of normality. It's a bit of a new normal for us all here.
Are people still on edge given what's happened?
There are some that are, especially in the non-burnt areas. It's hard not to be. After sort of three or four evacuations, it's hard not to keep your bags packed just in case. But there seems to be almost a sigh of everyone having a bit of a breath at the moment.
Yeah. We did see yesterday that the CFS said it had actually contained the fire. Today the conditions have been pretty windy. Does that tend to get people a little bit worried?
Absolutely. I don't think that there would be a person on the island that's not worried after the fires that we've had.
Sandy Davis at the store at Pandana on Kangaroo Island. So, Rhett, how long is the recovery going to take? And I guess that's really a question about the soul of the place and people's psychological state as much as the infrastructure and wilderness, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think the infrastructure will eventually be rebuilt. That's been lost. There'll also be homes that will be rebuilt as well. But I think the main thing here is that speaking to locals today, there's certainly a lot of hurt people around. I think it's fair to say. I spoke to one woman a short time ago who just explained to me that there's so many children in particular that are, you know, due to go to, back to school next week, and, you know, they're going back after a summer holiday like no other. This hasn't been a break for anyone, and it's going to be a long time before people will be able to put this behind them and for it to be a distant memory rather than what it is at the moment, which is their reality.
And just the physical environment, is there any greenery around, or are people living amongst a lot of, you know, burnt remnants and ash and so forth?
Yeah, it's amazing that you say that, Linda, because I was driving to Pandana from Kingscote earlier this afternoon, and that drive was really confronting. There was just all around me on both sides complete scorched earth and blackened trees with no leaves left on them, road signs that you could no longer read, and a lot of ash and smouldering areas as well that were travelling across the road. But then on one bend, if you looked beyond it, there was this strange patch of greenery flying in this morning. I can tell you that, yeah, from the sky, you can certainly see the damage that's been caused, but there are still some beautiful places here, and that's what locals are hoping that people will start to see, that tourists will start to see, and that they'll come across and put their hand in their pocket and, you know, spend a bit of time here as they try and recover.
Our reporter Rhett Burney on Kangaroo Island. Well, there is relief in large parts of New South Wales today because good rains have helped firefighters contain massive blazes that have ravaged parts of that state. Today, the Rural Fire Service put another notch on its belt. It's brought the Currawarn fire under control after it destroyed an estimated 500,000 hectares. But there are still fires burning in the eastern states. There are total fire bans in some places again today with hot weather. And there are still months of hot weather to come. So what lies ahead in terms of fires? Julia Holman has been taking a look.
It's taken 53 days, but the fire that ravaged the New South Wales south coast is today finally under control.
I think that the community is feeling quite relieved with it. There's a relief that it's been contained.
That's Patricia White, the Deputy Mayor of the Shoalhaven City Council.
Some people I have spoken to, the fire had visited their places up to 7 times on different occasions. And, you know, it's been devastating to go out there and see what this fire has done.
The south coast Currawarn fire alone destroyed an estimated 500,000 hectares, and across New South Wales, 5 million hectares have been burnt this fire season. In Victoria, more than 1 million hectares have been destroyed, and some parts of the state remain under threat. And there's been widespread destruction in parts of Queensland and South Australia. But with so much of the country's east coast already burnt, does that mean that the fire threat is now over?
No, it means that it's moving into a different pattern. So we've still got a ways to go. We've got to get into the autumn before we can put our feet up and go, wow, that was a bad fire season.
David Bowman is a professor of pyrogeography and fire science from the University of Tasmania. He says there are large parts of unburnt forested areas in Victoria, South Australia and Western Australia that pose a risk. And that's not all.
The place that's in the forefront of my mind is the east coast of Tasmania. Extremely dry. You know, it's a scary thought that the peak fire season in Tasmania is February.
Bureau of Meteorology climatologist Felicity Gamble says across Australia, many areas have gone through their driest and hottest year on record. That means they're primed for a long fire season.
We are still seeing an increased potential for bushfires across much of eastern Australia, parts of southern Australia, and also eastern Tasmania. So the fire season is by no means over.
She says rain over the past week hasn't been anywhere near enough to break the drought, and high temperatures into the 40s across parts of New South Wales tomorrow will start drying out the land once more.
It really only takes a few consecutive hot days to really dry out the landscape and then see it once again susceptible to bushfire.
The Bureau's outlook says that higher than average temperatures are likely into autumn. But there is better news when it comes to expected rainfall over the coming months.
It's not saying it's going to be particularly wet, but it's also not saying it's going to be particularly dry. So we may start to see a return to sort of more normal rainfall amounts.
Shoalhaven Deputy Mayor Patricia White says it's been a relief to have some rain and to finally breathe fresh air.
Areas are starting to sprout already with new growth. Over the next 6 to 12 months, you know, I would like a lot of tourists to come down and just see how we recover from this fire and how Mother Nature will, you know, give us back what we had.
Patricia White, the Deputy Mayor of Shoalhaven City Council. Julia Holman, our reporter. There's growing pressure on the Morrison government to organise louder condemnation of Iran for the continued imprisonment of British-Australian citizen Dr. Kylie Moore-Gilbert. An Iranian human rights group has published desperate letters Dr. Moore-Gilbert has written to her captors, pleading for better treatment and revealing that she rejected an attempt by Iran to co-opt her as a spy. Dr. Moore-Gilbert is a lecturer at Melbourne University and has been in the notorious Evan prison since September 2018, serving 10 years on espionage charges that she denies. This morning on AM, another former captive in Iran, the Washington Post journalist Jason Rezaian, was damning in his view of the Australian government's efforts.
The first thing that you worry about and that you think about for the beginning days, weeks, and as it drags into months of being isolated and cut off from the world is whether or not anybody's doing anything for you. And all of us assume early on that nothing is being done for us. In some cases, like Kylie's, that turns out to be the reality.
Well, another vocal Iran commentator agrees. Benham Bentaleblou is a senior fellow with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies in Washington, D.C., which takes a hard line on Iran and other key Middle East questions. I asked him first what value he thinks Kylie Moore-Gilbert would have to the Iranian regime.
Authorities in the Islamic Republic have sought to use either dual nationals, Iranian hyphenated individuals, or foreign nationals as pawns in their game of strategic competition with a foreign country. Iran has long used hostage taking, and make no mistake, this is hostage taking, as part and parcel of its foreign policy.
Why would they have chosen her in particular? I mean, she's an academic, an expert in Islamic studies. Do we know anything about the logic of her targeting in the first place?
Well, looking at that background, I'm glad you mentioned both the academic portion, basically a nonprofit career, an educational career, and the Islamic studies component, knowledge of the faith, knowledge of the region. These are people that Iran has targeted before. And in particular, it's assumed that Dr. Gilbert Moore, I should say, knows Arabic, and it's assumed she knows a little bit of Farsi, because what's reported about her is that she has apologized, according to The Guardian, for her poor Farsi, using these letters to even be overtly polite to her captors in Iran. So those backgrounds raise suspicion, but in Iran, but around the rest of the world, we know that that type of background is something to be commended. It's not a national security background. It's simply an academic background, but Iran doesn't see it that way.
So what might be the trade-off for Kylie Moore-Gilbert's freedom, do you think?
Well, it's important not to see it as a trade-off, because one trade-off can lead to another. One bad deal can beget a worse deal. And this is not the sort of predicate that Australia should be looking to engage in with Iran. You know, unfortunately, you can say that Washington or even some Western countries in the past have had something of a quid pro quo, if you can use that phrase now, or a prisoner swap, or even of a delay in prisoner exchanges for political purposes. You know, when you look at the history of West-Iran relations, France, Lebanese Hezbollah, and Iran, there were hostage phasings and takings that played into the national politics of Lebanon, national politics of Iran, national politics of France. And I think Australia should stay away from this.
And so what more then can the Australian government do? The Australian Foreign Minister says she recently raised Kylie Moore-Gilbert's case with her Iranian counterpart, but he would not be moved. Today, Jason Rezaian, who the Washington Post reporter, who was himself held for more than 500 days with his wife in Iran before being released, he says Australia's not doing enough. So what more could be done?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the case of someone like Jason Rezaian because, having former hostages, former detainees echo the plight of current detainees, current hostages, is something that could happen. It could be something organized by the Australian government, could be something organized by the Australian-Iranian diaspora community. It could simply be another vector of pressure for the foreign ministry in Australia to bring to bear on Iran, to cite the conditions under which previous people were released and say, do our citizens not deserve the same, if not more? So there's more pressure, obviously, that could be brought to bear, but more publicity. That's really the key part. There seems to be a tendency when some countries have hostages or prisoners in Iran to downplay, to keep it out of the news cycle. You've seen this in the past with Australia, of course. In fact, I think more publicity, constantly reminding and naming and shaming the Iranian authorities responsible for these detentions, these gross human rights violations, that, of course, I think can play a role in expediting the release of the likes of Moore Gilbert, as well as anyone else.
Benham Bentaleblou, thank you very much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And Benham Bentaleblou is a senior fellow at the Washington-based Foundation for the Defence of Democracies. And in a statement, a foreign affairs spokesman in Canberra says Dr. Moore-Gilbert's case is a very high priority, that the minister has raised the case with her Iranian counterpart multiple times. It says, we are doing everything possible in relation to the conditions of her imprisonment. And it says, we continue to believe the best way to secure a successful outcome is through diplomatic channels, not through the media. Well, if the raft of new compliance jobs on offer in Australian banking is any indication, there seems to be a race to clean up the Banking Act after damning revelations from the Royal Commission. Banks are changing their operating systems and promising improved culture, so there's a jobs boom in areas like compliance. But recruitment agencies are questioning whether it's all about positive change or about the challenge that's coming from new, leaner, cleaner banks. Here's our business reporter, David Taylor.
Martin North worked in retail banking for one of the big four banks in the 80s and 90s. He reckons compliance was little more than an afterthought for most banks.
And it was all about selling products and services and earning commissions and all those things. And they didn't put any of the checks and balances in place around that, neither in the UK nor in Australia.
In 2018 and 2019, the Hayne Royal Commission exposed the banks for underinvesting in the processes and systems that pick up dodgy business practices.
I think a lot of the root cause issues that we've had over the last decade or so has been from fundamentally flogging products at any cost and not thinking holistically about the risks and therefore the compliance aspects that should be there.
Banking recruitment firm Hayes says the banks are now boosting their ranks of compliance and regulatory officers. It reports that credit assessors, business development managers and regulatory compliance managers make the list of the jobs in most demand. But regional director Carl PC says compliance and anti-money laundering roles top the list.
Certainly risk and compliance is driving a lot of the demands. Anti-money laundering has been huge, and a large number of organizations have been increasing headcount in this area to satisfy anti-money laundering obligations and the scrutiny from AUSTRAC. And then that all ties into change managers coming in to help these organizations meet these requirements and then ensure that they're hitting what's being asked of them.
And while there is demand for change managers, or bank staff whose role it is to change organisational structures within the bank, most of the reorganisation within the banks, says Mr PC, is being driven by fear of losing customers to rivals.
Oh, look, in this space, what we're seeing is new organisations coming into the market. The fintechs and the neobanks are disrupting the market. They've got very strong technology-built platforms. They've got extremely competitive products and rates, and in conjunction with a number of disillusioned customers working with the large organizations, they're voting with their feet and going to these new, smaller challenger organizations. And these organizations are growing quite quickly, and that's
having a knock-on demand for staffing.
Former banker Martin North says this highlights how far the banks still need to go to rebuild their reputations and regain public trust.
And there was an example quite recently of you know, one of the superannuation funds who've now it's realised they're refunding superannuation back to the people who actually should never have been charged in the first place, but they've created another superannuation fund. That's a classic example of not changing the culture. So they've basically tried to solve the particular problem, but not the culture. And that's the issue. This is a cultural change. So compliance officers and compliance processes are only about 5% of the issue, in my view.
Former banker Martin North, David Taylor with that report. I'm Linda Mottram. That is PM for today. You can always find us at the ABC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts. That's where you should subscribe and leave us a review too. AM and The World Today are also there, so subscribe to them and leave them a review as well. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. There's nothing like a rhyming scandal to ruin the start of your year. Sports Rorts, as it's known in some quarters, is a government grants program that is attracting a lot of attention right now, and not the good kind.
Today, the problem with how this money was spent and what kind of trouble the government is in because of it. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.